Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is my great pleasure to have with us as an introduction to both the program's discussion of a variety of aspects of that war, but also to help us reflect on a terrible event that took place in this country 16 years ago to the day, that was, for many of us at least, a wake-up call that we were even in a war for the free world, let alone how dangerous it is. He is Dr. Harold Rode. He comes to us at the moment from Israel, but he is a man who I've come to know and admire greatly for his work in the United States government for decades, as really one of the go-to people about matters involving the Islamic world, especially several of its most important countries, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. He is the author of a terrific new monograph for the Center for Security Policy entitled Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. I'm going to talk with him about how it marched on to us here in Washington and in New York and elsewhere on the 11th of September, 2001. Dr. Harold Rode, welcome back. It's so good to have you, sir.
And great to be here, Frank. It's always a joy.
So, Harold, reflect for us, if you would, on both what happened to us on that day, not just the attacks themselves, but what the whole point was, and its abiding relevance, especially the failure, it would seem to me, of American leaders of both parties to understand the Sharia supremacist impetus behind what happened.
I think they chose not to understand, because had they done so, it would require them to act differently than what they were prepared to do. To give you an example, we spent a lot of time in Bush Jr. administration trying to figure out what we were going to call the enemy. We didn't, God forbid, want to use the word Islam, and we didn't want to use the word jihad, because which means holy war, and it has nothing to do historically with the making yourself a better person. That's maybe 2% of what it is. It is carrying the war, the religious war, to make the whole world Muslim. A very interesting perspective on September 11th is how the Muslims understood this. Now, Muslims look for dates that matter to them, and this was an attack against the West. Now, America runs the West from a Muslim point of view. It's the head of the West. And if we look back in history, the Muslims, that is, the Turks, were stopped at Vienna in 1683, a long time ago. But it's interesting when the Turks were forced to retreat, when they were defeated. And it is no coincidence, Frank, that that date was September 11th, 1683. Muslims are very interested in symbolism. 1683 is a long time ago, something that happened 3 days ago or even an hour ago. We say, oh, that's history. Like, who cares? They care.
Right. They care big time. And Harold, what this act of jihad against the United States, whatever we chose to call it, was generated in the service of an effort to impose on this country Sharia and all that flows from it, really a totalitarian political, military, and legal system. And yet, just as you say, we've not only chosen to avert our gaze from the Islamic character of this, the jihadist nature of the attack, but also that underlying program. Is there any chance, as a professional with long experience and great credentials in this space, that if we persist in failing to understand these realities, that we can possibly prevail over the Sharia supremacists?
Frank, we have to do what is necessary to defeat them, that they understand that they are defeated, not how we wish to define it. The way things are at the moment, all we do is demonstrate weakness. And I want to go back to, again, this concept of symbolism. The World Trade Center means two things, or meant two things, to the Muslims. Number one, it is a symbol of American power, of American financial power, American everything. And it was these, when they destroyed these two buildings, they are saying, let's say, the four-letter word to the West. And the way we reacted was weakness in their, from their point of view. I can tell you, having worked at the Pentagon at the time, that the American people, what the American people sent into the Pentagon, letters, quilts that they did, they were prepared to stand up and fight this force. We couldn't even decide what to call it. And we came up after two or three years with the word GWAT, the Global War on Terrorism. That's like saying in World War II that the Americans or the British were fighting the U-boats instead of saying we were fighting the German Nazis. You must identify the enemy, and we refused to do that back then. And what scares me now is that there's some in the present administration who don't want to say, call it for what it is. It's Islamic terrorism.
Harold Rode, let me talk to you about one of the countries that is a prime mover behind this, a country that you know very intimately, Turkey. It has, of course, under its current president, longtime Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, inexorably moved from a democratic Muslim state to a full-throated Islamist republic, it seems to me. At the moment, it is rounding up American citizens and German citizens and subjecting them to arrest. What's up with that, Harold? And what should we expect if we avert our gaze from whatever the impetus is?
Turkey under Erdogan is no longer an American ally. They are working against us. They talk about democratic values. But, you know, Erdogan says whatever he finds necessary to put us on the defensive. He blamed the coup, which I believe he was behind, the coup against him. The people that he's arresting, he's saying these people are disappearing in the jails, and we know they're being tortured. We've got pictures of what they look like after they've been in jail. Well, and what is our response? To get defensive. Oh, well, he said so, so it must be true. It's not true. Now, the question then, what Muslim country or what Muslim force is an ally of the United States? And there is exactly one, and that is the Kurds, who on the 25th of September are going to have a referendum in Iraq whether they should go for independence. These are people that whatever happens, they're on our side. They're not trying to make everybody else into Kurds or Muslims or anybody else. What's the proof of that? When there's trouble there, all the people who are under attack flee to Iraqi Kurdistan. That's Christians, Yazidis, that's all sorts of people. And the Kurds accept them, and they don't try to force them to be Kurds.
The Turks would, of course, be very happy with the prospect of an independent Kurdistan, even if it's carved out of the territory the Kurds currently occupy in Iraq. I assume so would the Iranians, as they and the Syrians as well have Kurds on their soil. How would the Turks respond should the Iraqi Kurds take that stance?
Well, they hope at the moment that the threats are enough. But the truth is, and why it is so important to the Turks, is that the Interior Ministry of Turkey knows now that the population of Turkey is about 50% Kurdish and 50% Turkish. Erdogan says that we'll reach that number in the year 2038. But the definition of a Kurd is not what I say or what you say it is, Frank. It's what people say they are. And in the Middle East, you are what your father is. And that's how it's understood in Turkey. I have met many people in Turkey who don't know Kurdish, who have not lived in what are the traditional Kurdish areas of Turkey, which is the southeast, that they're in Istanbul, they're in other cities, and they don't know any Kurdish. And they are one, you ask them what they are, and they're three or four generations in Istanbul. I'm a Kurd. I'm not a Turk.
Fascinating. Harold Rode, this is a subject we're going to be returning to, I know, with you as this date approaches. The 25th of September, the Kurdish referendum for independence from Iraq. thank you for sharing this insight with us, as well as your others, about the nature of modern Islamic warfare, the subject of your terrific monograph at the Center for Security Policy. You can download it for free at securefreedom.org, folks. Check it out. Harold Rode, thank you so much for your time today and your great work for our country over so many years. Keep it up and come back to us soon, my friend. Gordon Chang joins us next. We'll talk with him about the coming Maoist return to China. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are welcoming once again, as we have the privilege of doing each week, Gordon Chang to our microphones. Gordon is, of course, our duty expert on matters involving Asia. He is also that, I'm pleased to say, of The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal, Fox News, and so many other outlets. We prize our time with him because Gordon, drawing on his considerable expertise, his two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, is invaluable in terms of helping us understand what is going on in the sometimes inscrutable Far East. Gordon, so good to have you. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank, and I prize my time with you.
Well, thank you. Let me ask you, Gordon, about the latest developments on North Korea. Of course, as we've been discussing now for quite some time, and you've been writing about forever, we're dealing with a very dangerous regime. It has now tested what some believe is, in fact, as it claims, an H-bomb. It now has ballistic missiles. It says it can mate the H-bomb on its missiles. As we speak, the UN is considering some new round of sanctions. So is the United States. While we can't say for sure what the UN is going to do today, as we discuss this, we'll know by the time this airs. But what are your thoughts, Gordon, on what's happening and whether this set of sanctions now being considered will make a difference?
It's been reported by Bloomberg that the United States has watered down the sanctions. It originally proposed a complete oil embargo on North Korea. Now there's going to be some permitted sales of oil and refined products. The problem here is that if you permit some sales, it's very hard to monitor what's going on, to monitor compliance. And we know that the Chinese are going to honor it at first, but they won't honor it a couple months down the road. So what's needed here is, first of all, incredible vigilance on the part of the United States. But also, I think that we have the power to deal with the Chinese, and we're not actually exercising it. And my view would be we propose a set of UN sanctions. If the Chinese don't go for them, then we actually impose the sanctions on China as well. We're getting to the point where the North Koreans are gaining the capabilities to put the United States at risk. The last detonation looks like it was a thermonuclear device. They can mate it on a missile now. We don't have very much time to figure this out. Our margin for error is really thin. We need to go after the North Koreans with everything we got.
Gordon, my friend Steve Bannon was on 60 Minutes last night, and he said very explicitly, this is not a North Korea problem, this is a China problem. I know you've been of that view for some time. The president has talked about actually seriously and directly impacting China's trade with the United States if it insists on doing business with North Korea. Now, again, as you say, if we're going to relax the nature of this restrictions on North Korea, that would be not only difficult to enforce in its own right, but make more problematic such a trade embargo on China. But what's your reading on how serious an option this is and its implications?
Well, I think the president wants to do something. I'm sure that his advisors caution him against moving against China in a vigorous way. But we see the president coming back again and again with ideas that really are actually quite good. And so you can sort of guess that there's this push and pull in the administration. But Bannon is absolutely right. This is a China problem. Because without China, North Korea would not have the means to stand up to the international community. I don't know if China could ever convince Kim Jong-un of anything, but certainly it could convince the people around him, the critical team elements that are actually the ones who run North Korea. So we've got to recognize that this is an issue. Global Times, which is the nationalistic tabloid run by People's Daily, the most authoritative publication in China, had an editorial on this where it said that this is not really China's problem. And that editorial was pulled from the web. I think that we've got to understand that Beijing really is not that serious. They're not that serious because we have not been that serious with regard to China. You know, the Chinese will get serious when we do. I hope the Trump administration starts to change its attitudes in this regard, because otherwise we're going to get the same ineffective results.
You know, Senator John McCain was on the Sunday show talking about extinction being the price of aggression on the part of the North Koreans. I'm concerned that our ability to make that threat credibly isn't all that it should be, but it can only be further undermined if we wind up making empty assertions of consequences without the ability to back them up. And whether that's from the Congress or whether that's from the executive, I think the same basic message applies. Gordon, speaking of China, I did want to ask, you've got a piece in Forbes today talking about the possibility of a new Maoist era there. Talk about what that means and why it seems in prospect.
On October 18th, the Communist Party convenes its 19th National Congress. The Congress is held these days once every 5 years. Xi Jinping, the ruler of China, looks like he's going to consolidate his position. If he does, he's probably going to be even more belligerent and more provocative than he has been up to the past. And if he doesn't consolidate his position, China, we could see disunity in the regime, debilitating, infighting, all sorts of things. So I don't see any good outcomes for the international community after this Congress. But it's important that we watch this, because we got to see which direction China is going. Xi Jinping has been taking the country backwards from an economic point of view. He's also been much more provocative toward its neighbors in the United States. This is a country that is bound to move in the wrong directions, and we've got to be very careful about what's going on. And as Bannon says, this is a China issue when we talk about North Korea, when we talk about Iran, other things. We have to recognize that China is trying to undermine the United States, and we need to do everything we can to protect ourselves, our friends, and allies.
Gordon, let me just ask you as a sanity check. I mean, again, you've been writing now and speculating about the collapse of China. There has certainly been a lot of evidence that the Chinese people have been fed up with the party and the corruption that is rampant under its misrule. Would the people of China likely be willing to submit once again to the kind of cultural revolution that we saw in the bad old days of Mao? Or do you think this really could precipitate, if Xi Jinping tries to go that way, the sort of collapse that you have forecast?
Yeah, Xi Jinping is not a Mao in the sense that Mao thought about permanent revolution, continuous revolution, the two phrases that he used. But Xi Jinping likes the Maoist economic model, because we see he's pumped a lot of money into the economies, more state control of the financial system, all the rest of it. We've seen in the past the effect of Maoist-type moves on China's economy. And right now, they've got a little bit of a mini-boom. I think that's because he has tried to pump a lot of money into the economy so that nothing would go wrong before the 19th Party Congress. But this is completely unsustainable. And so I think that, you know, we see the Chinese people already voting, taking their money out of the country, and the wealthy trying to leave. I think that's a real indication where the smart money is going in China right now. A lot of people can't leave. They're frustrated. They're coerced. They very well may not be able to do anything. But those people with options are heading to the exits, and that's a real indication of the real distress in Chinese society these days.
We will be watching how that distress plays out in the Party Congress and beyond. Gordon Chang, with your very considerable help, we appreciate your time each week and look forward to your updates at Forbes and the Daily Beast, World Affairs Journal, and more, as well as our visit with you next week. Thank you, Gordon. Good day, and keep up the great work. Next up, we'll speak with Stephen Lambakis about the threat the Chinese, among others, are creating to us and our interests in space. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we're joined by Dr. Stephen Lambakis. He is, among other things, the author of a very important piece that we will be discussing with him in the next few minutes, a product of the highly regarded National Institute for Public Policy, where he is, among other things, a senior analyst and managing editor of its comparative strategy. He is also the author of Foreign Space Capabilities, Implications for U.S. National Security, among other publications, On the Edge of Earth, The Future of American Space Power, among them. I couldn't be more pleased to have a chance to talk with him about this great paper. Steve Lambakis, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
So there are, I think, people in this country who know probably what you do about space, but the vast majority of us probably tuned out when we stopped walking on the moon, more or less. Give us a sense of what's happening there. You know, there's been a lot of talk about not militarizing space. Is that generally the practice of nations that are hostile to us?
Well, it is the practice for a few of them, at least. Some of them are paying a great deal of attention to U.S. space operations, in large part because they are the reason the United States is such a dominant military power. You know, makes sense. They're looking for a way to sort of undercut that advantage. So, yes. And, you know, since the time on the moon, space has actually become a big deal.
For both national security and commercial reasons, as you make clear in your paper. And when you say that they're paying attention, some of them are not simply observing what we're doing or simply appreciating how important space is to our situational awareness and command and control of our forces and the like, Steve. But it's also something that they're actively working to neutralize in terms of our advantage in that area. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think that the central message of my report that just published is that threats to the United States, our space systems, are advancing at a rate that outpaces actually what the United States is doing to mitigate those threats. Okay, so for decades we've been treating space as a benign environment, despite some activities during the Cold War. You know, we've had certain development activities. The Soviets had certain development activities. With China's 2013 launch, they launched a ballistic missile type weapon towards geosynchronous orbit. That has caused the Department of Defense, I think, to have a sort of a counter space reawakening, is what they're calling it. And so we've taken steps to passively protect our systems, but there's certainly more that needs to be done.
And when you talk about a ballistic missile, you're basically saying it's something that could lob, for example, a nuclear weapon, I suppose, or perhaps some sort of anti-satellite weapon to the altitudes at which some of our most important space systems operate, right?
Right. And of course, we have very critical assets in geosynchronous orbit, Earth early warning communications satellites. And these are the big strategic assets that we are very concerned about protecting.
And if we were to have those compromised, how serious a degradation would it impose on our military capabilities, particularly to project power?
So on the military side, we have reconnaissance and high-resolution intelligence satellites that help us with planning and delivering of tactical intelligence. So these are vulnerable to not only attacks by direct ascent ASAT type weapons because they are so low from Russia and China, but also from countries like North Korea and Iran. We have a ballistic missile defense system that depends on early warning satellites that are in high Earth orbit or geosynchronous orbit. So these could be blinded, dazzled with lasers and degraded to some extent. And they help us to detect and provide initial track information.
Okay, so with all of this said, and much more of it at greater length described in your new paper, Foreign Space Capabilities Implication for U.S. National Security, Dr. Stephen Lebakis, let me ask you, when you sort of cast your eye at what the United States is doing, how close to the challenge are we in terms of having the kind of counter space capabilities that you're talking about? For example, what are our space launch capabilities? Should we need to reconstitute constellations of satellites that are taken down, or simply put into space kind of capabilities that might help protect those assets?
We don't have a very good responsive launch capability right now, though it's understood within the Air Force that we need to get there. It'd be nice to be in a position to replenish our assets should they be taken down, to make the entire architecture more resilient. There are other steps that we have taken, however, for with our global protection system satellites, the GPS, that are so important to our daily use and to the military, which also uses these satellites for precision guided weapons. They have spares on orbit, and they have a fairly robust constellation. So to some extent, we are prepared to lose some of those satellites. So it really depends on what constellation you're talking about. For right now, is a fairly long, long turnaround time to get new satellites into orbit.
Let me ask you about one particular aspect of capabilities that we're seeing the Chinese developing, and that is satellites, and I think even space stations and space planes, that all seem to have as common denominators the ability to take on military missions, and perhaps through maneuvering towards our satellites or jamming them or blinding them, be able to alter what's happening there in space. Again, our situational awareness and particularly military capabilities, perhaps. But beyond that, there's also the possibility of projecting power from space. Do we at the moment have anything remotely like those kinds of capabilities? And if not, should we be getting them?
Well, I would say that at this day and age, we have primitive space application of assets, space force application assets, and so do the Chinese, and so do the Russians, and the North Koreans and Iranians. They have ballistic missile capabilities, which put payloads into space. They travel through the space environment, and they come down through space on their targets. Beyond that, the United States does not have such other types of space force application assets. But these other ones are quite serious and need to be addressed. And of course, that's what our missile defense system is for.
Do you anticipate that with this awakening, as you call it, this counter space epiphany, that those kinds of capabilities are now in development by the United States? And if not, should they be?
I would not say they're in development. I think we're still, working through this problem. What I do think that we need is just two things. We need to have a stronger deterrent strategy, because currently we have what they call a deterrence by denial type of strategy, which is the use of passive defenses, mobility, redundancy in our networks and so forth, essentially to frustrate the adversary, because there are so many out there. Maybe we're leveraging commercial systems or allied systems for communications or navigation, and that's a good tactic, but I question, is that enough? I think that we need to add a little bit more emphasis to our deterrence and emphasize a deterrence by punishment approach. That is a complicated thing to do because we don't necessarily want to be attacking adversary assets in space. So we need to give that a good, long, hard look. We also, I believe, need to look at space-based interceptors. I think these assets would be critical not only to our missile defense mission, but also to satellite defense. They're in the ideal environment, I believe, because the entire Earth and the space above it is the battleground.
It is indeed. That's really a critical insight, and one that I think those of you at the National Institute for Public Policy are so helpfully contributing to our understanding of. Steve Limbakis, I appreciate this chance to visit with you very briefly. We've only skimmed the surface, and I hope that we can do so at much greater length in the near future. But in the meantime, I commend to everyone at NIPP.org, Foreign Space Capabilities Implications for U.S. National Security. Steve, thanks so much for your time today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're going to talk with a man who has just literally been weathering one of the worst storms in American history. Fortunately, it apparently dodged him and his community on the east coast of Florida, but it is still playing out elsewhere in the state. He is Russ Dallin, one of our duty experts on Latin America, but first we'll take stock with him on what's been happening here in his native state. Russ, I gather you have fared reasonably well, thank God, and it's great to have you with us to give us a status report on what's been happening as a result of Hurricane Irma.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's good to be here and good to be able to tell you and to give you a status report.
Well, give us just a quick flavor of what has been happening both in your immediate community and elsewhere in the state.
We dodged a bullet in the easiest sense of the term. At one point, we were talking about a hurricane with 185 mile an hour winds that literally flattened San Martin and Barbuda, the first islands that it hit. And for once, Cuba did us a favor and slowed it down as it touched the outer shore of that. And so that when it did finally come up this way, it was had 125 mile an hour winds, but it skirted up the western coast. It left most of Miami-Dade and Broward without power. The poor people in the Keys first saw it, the Florida Keys and Key West. They bore the brunt of the impact of its first land in America. And then between Naples, Fort Myers, and Tampa, they got the rest of it. And before it dissipates up into Georgia and Tennessee.
I understand that your own personal house was very narrowly missed by a falling tree. Thank God for that. And I guess for the relatively light treatment that your part of the state received, do we have any idea how long the power will be out? I gather there are several million that are affected at the moment. Yours seems to be back on, thank goodness.
Yes, we got power back on shortly before midnight, and but we are not so close to the water. I mean, there, Brickell Avenue was literally flooded, the downtown Miami area where all of the high finance and businesses are located, literally had 6 feet of water. There is still a lot to be recovered there. There's a curfew in it for most of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. The Miami Beach is still not letting people in yet.
Let me ask you to switch gears with, again, congratulations for dodging that bullet, to talk about another topic that we frequently discuss with you, Russ Dallin, especially in light of your expertise as the publisher of the Latin American Herald Tribune, namely, what is going on at the moment in Venezuela? I gather that the regime there has now turned on one of its, the golden goose, I guess you'd call it, PDVSA, by arresting some of its top management. What's going on there, and what are the implications for that source of revenue for the regime and the economy of Venezuela, which has already been devastated by Hurricane Chavez and Maduro?
Well, it's all thanks to American law enforcement. As a matter of fact, the FBI arrested 2 years ago a fellow named Roberto Rincon and another associate. He's in Texas, Houston, Texas, and another associate named Abraham Shira, who both pled guilty now. And Shira is here in Miami. for being involved in a billion-dollar kickback scheme with PDVSA.
Did you say billion-dollar kickback scheme?
Billion with a B, yes, sir. Billion with a B. They have pled guilty, as well as a number of other U.S. residents and Venezuelan residents in America who were involved in the kickback. And basically, it works like this. You want to buy an oil pump, and it costs $100 million. So we'll bill it at $200 million, and we'll split the extra $100 million between the two of us. And that's typically how those things go. That was unfortunately widespread, but it took American law enforcement to uncover it and start cracking down on it. But the U.S. judge has refused thus far that request. But because the former attorney general had turned against the regime and started prosecuting them for those crimes, including Odebrecht, which also had another $100 million in bribes that they've admitted to Venezuelan officials, including Diosdado Cabello and others. But they chased her out of town. She literally is an expatriate now. They tried to rake over the fire when she announced that there was that the government was committing a coup against democracy and in all of its actions that it was taking, including the Constituent National Assembly. And she had been a loyal Chavista, by the way.
Is she still a fugitive as a result of this persecution?
Yes, she is a fugitive. She and her husband, was a national congressman as well, deputado, and they're both fugitives from Venezuela. But they, luckily, she fled with a pen drive full of documents and has been going around Latin America and the U.S. Providing those documents to all and sundry of their end of the implications of all of these high Venezuelan officials.
So she's actually in the United States or has been, as far as we know?
I think she's in Mexico. She's in Mexico right now. She's been offered asylum in Colombia, Brazil, and Peru, I believe, so far. But she hasn't, she and her husband haven't decided yet. They've been touring around, meeting with other prosecutor generals, sharing the evidence and trying to see what they can do to bring justice. But the new attorney general of Venezuela had to look like he was doing something. So they basically threw up some low-level people that didn't matter and could be sacrificed and blamed them. So although it makes great headlines, 8 PDVSA officials arrested, they were actually not the big cheese or the intellectual authors of the crime.
Very quickly, let me just ask you as well, Russ Dallin, there is a new constituent assembly in Venezuela, of course. The end of the democracy there as a practical matter has led to this. The statement that was made by the president of it, Delcy Rodriguez, caught my attention to the effect that there's no humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. From your reporting at the Latin American Herald Tribune and your other insights into what's happening there, Russ Dallin, is that remotely correct?
No, not at all. It's ludicrously incorrect. And it's amazing that she was the former foreign minister before she got appointed to this position of head of this illegal and illicit body, super body. It'd be like, by the way, just so you understand what that National Constituent Assembly is, it would be like if Trump couldn't get the Republicans and Democrats to do what he wanted, so he just appointed a whole new Congress above this Congress. The old Congress would still exist, but he made a new one with the superpower abilities to do everything,
including rewrite the Constitution and remove people from office. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So but she is she's a lifelong communist. And, you know, the Venezuelans have long gone by this policy of better to deny the truth than open your mouth and prove it. Even though malnutrition is incredibly rising, infant mortality is devastating the country, they behave like as if nothing is wrong.
Much is wrong, needless to say. Russ Dallin, we're delighted that you've made it through the storm. Thank you for taking a few minutes in the aftermath of it to recount how things are going there. And I hope that the cleanup and the restoration of power and life as we know it in Florida will be speedy and readily accomplished. Russ, thank you for your time today. We'll talk with you soon.
to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our senior fellow on economic warfare matters, Kevin Freeman. He is, of course, a best-selling author with Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He is also the driving force behind an incredibly valuable internet resource, globaleconomicwarfare.com. We are delighted every week to be able to pick his brains, especially on the occasion of 9/11, the anniversary of two attacks of that day, the second of which isn't widely understood to have been similar in some respects, and perhaps motivated by some of the same people who were behind the attack of 16 years ago. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you back, especially to be able to explore with you those two interesting dates.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's an interesting day to be here. It's a solemn day, and it's certainly a day that we should remember in prayer.
Amen to that. You have made the point that 9/11/2001 was an economic warfare attack. We spoke earlier in the program with Harold Rode about kind of its military implications, but discuss the economic character and consequences of the 9/11 strikes.
The targets, which include the political target, the White House, Congress, the military target, the Pentagon, and the financial target, which was the World Trade Center towers, just demonstrates Osama bin Laden's intent was not to kill the most number of people. He could have waited for a Saturday in the fall and gone into a Michigan football stadium or Ohio State or any of the large stadiums and easily taken out hundreds of thousands of people, not 3,000. He chose the World Trade Center because it was not only a symbolic target, but with the assumption that it would be an economic attack that would potentially take down our economy.
On that day, as well as going after the World Trade Center, some 7 years later, they went after the economic underpinning of our market. Talk about that attack, Kevin Freeman.
Well, and that's a little known or understood, but the real linchpin of when our financial system collapsed in 2008, everybody will tell you this, George Soros said it and everybody else, it was the failure of Lehman Brothers. And the beginning of the failure of Lehman Brothers started on September 11th, 2008. It started with direct connections to the Muslim Brotherhood out of Qatar, where they were purposely naked short selling, which is a complex financial way of, they were attacking Lehman Brothers and making it impossible for people to buy their stock or support them in any way. That literally a blitzkrieg attack, you go in and you sell a bunch of Lehman Brothers stock that you don't own, haven't borrowed, don't own at all, and you sell it and people panic. It's a run on the bank, and a week later, Lehman Brothers files for bankruptcy, and then the whole financial system begins to collapse shortly thereafter.
Kevin Freeman, this is the subject of your extraordinarily important book, Secret Weapon, How Economic Warfare Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. Remind us, Kevin, of who you think was behind that second 9/11 attack.
We've traced directly connections to Barclays Bank that was at the time not fully owned, but heavily owned by the sovereign wealth fund in Qatar, which was headed up by a man you've taught me about, Yusuf Qaradawi, a Muslim Brotherhood, anti-American, pro-Sharia, really a terrible guy that I think he's Egyptian. I think if he went to Egypt today, he'd be arrested.
And to the extent that that attack was aimed at undermining our economy, it really underscores the point that you have made often on this program and elsewhere about economic warfare really being an instrument in the quiver of or in the hands of our enemies, one we fail to understand, let alone respond appropriately to at our extreme peril. What is the prospect, Kevin, as you see it, that we may see a repeat of this kind of attack in the stock market or other parts of our economy?
We've seen a number of attacks already. We've seen what is known as the flash crash, where we have no idea where the source of the attack came from, if it was a glitch or whatever. We've seen the Syrian Electronic Army purposely put out false tweets with the intention of causing a stock market crash, and we saw, you know, billions of dollars wiped off of market value for a few minutes as they did this. And we've seen it written up repeatedly that this is a way to attack the United States of America. And yet we have no agency and no part of the government that is dedicated to protecting our markets.
Yeah, it's something, as I say, that they ignore at their peril. Let me ask you, Kevin Freeman, about another aspect of, it's economic warfare, I guess, of a kind. We're told that Vladimir Putin has been advising Russian companies that if they want to do business with the Russian government, which is a big player in their market, of course, they must use domestically generated software, apparently out of concern that foreign-produced software could have trapdoors and otherwise be utilized by us or others against them. This reminds me of an episode that has gotten altogether too little attention, and that is Hillary Clinton's direct role in promoting what has come to be called the Silicon Valley of Russia, namely Skolkovo. Having capitalized on engineering the transfer of sensitive military and other technologies to Russia, Hillary Clinton's foundation benefited greatly while she was Secretary of State from the creation and building up of Skolkovo. Kevin Freeman, to the extent you can, is there a connection possibly between what we have helped engineer in the way of a domestic source of software and other high technology for Russia and this step that Putin is now taking, which may have national security implications for us?
Well, there's all kinds of implications. First off, if we had not done what Secretary Clinton did and pursued building the Silicon Valley of Russia, they likely would not have the capability to use primarily domestic software in applications. They would rely on us. So he's probably right. Foreign governments do insert code into software, Russia being key among them. So that's a warning to our Pentagon as well. Don't use Russian software. It should be a warning to American business. Don't use Russian software. Don't use Chinese software. The Chinese are notorious for this. We're in an economic war. The problem is that most Americans think that all of this is a global marketplace. And what I'm trying to suggest is we're actually in a global battle space in the cyber area, in the economic area, and so forth. So when we transfer American technology, which is something the Clintons have done back since the original Bill Clinton administration, we transferred enormous amounts of technology to China. And when we do that, we put our nation at risk. Intellectual property theft is a serious problem. So that's tied to this. Now, the idea that they're going to cut off access of American software for use in Russia, and the Chinese have taken a different approach. They said, we'll use your software if you'll give us the code to it and let us see exactly where all the security is so we can ensure that our people are safe. What we're handing them is an ability to unlock our back door for all of our software.
Yeah, and use it against us in economic warfare. Kevin Freeman, this was a subject of a very interesting exchange between Steve Bannon and Charlie Rose on 60 Minutes last night, where he talked about the Chinese technology theft and extortion of American companies for their technological seed corn. Fascinating viewing and very much along the lines, I know, of what you have been talking about and warning of at globaleconomicwarfare.com and elsewhere. Come back to us next week if you would. Thanks so much for your time today. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.